Welcome to the Whole Enchilada, a community of high achievers that fight the status quo, rebel against mediocrity, and make life happen. Let's go. Hey, Enchilada Nation, really excited to be with you again today. And I have another really exciting guest and a friend of mine in the conversation, Brandon Ducharme, a wealth advisor. We were introduced, how few months ago, maybe 6 months ago, you and I really started talking.
Yeah, about then.
It's like 6 months. And I will tell you, incredibly sharp guy. You guys are going to love the conversation today. But I will tell you, a lot of you guys know that I do have some skepticism around financial advisors in general, because I think most of them don't think the way we think as entrepreneurs. And that is not the case with Brandon. And I've been overly impressed with his energy, his knowledge, but also coming from a place of like, he is an entrepreneur. He's in our space as far as building wealth, building businesses. And I just love his mentality and his take on things. So today we're going to have a wealth building conversation in regards to a net worth statement and a cash flow statement. So there's some element of confusion around the two of those, how they they're two separate things, but they interplay in a really specific way. So we're going to have that conversation. And if you think you know everything about a net worth statement and a cash flow statement, there's some things that shift and change with that in the economy we're in now that we're going to talk through today. So stick around. But real quickly, before we jump into that topic, Brandon, give us a little bit of a background on who you are personally, professionally, before we jump into this.
Thanks, Marcus. Professionally, a registered investment advisor, carry an insurance license, a real estate license, run business across all three of those major lines while I'm helping people manage their wealth. Come from a family, it's kind of the family trade. My grandpa brought himself up after World War II, after growing up in the Great Depression, taught himself how to invest, started developing land, built homes, ended up retiring as the director of housing and urban development in Wisconsin. Taught my dad how to save and invest as a kid. I had my dad trading stocks at 11 years old. My dad built on the family farm. That's where I grew up. So kind of it's all passed on down through the generations, if you will. I have a young family and I'm a veteran. Out here putting hard work to the test and trying to build a legacy for myself and others.
Oh, I love that. I didn't hear that before about your grandpa coming from the Great Depression. I knew that one generation in front of you was in wealth building. I realized it was two generations deep, but it sparked a thought for me when you brought that up that I think it's interesting. You see a lot of those people from the era of the Great Depression. It seems like a lot of them valued money differently because they went without, right? It was about making the dollar go a longer way. It was interesting to me is kind of looking at a bunch of different histories. Some people came out of that from a complete place of scarcity of like, I'm going to remain frugal. And some people came out of that saying, I can use that skill set of being frugal to build wealth that my family and my legacy aren't going to find themselves in this scenario again. But I think we find ourselves in a really interesting time right now, coming off of really a decade of incredible run-up in almost any asset class of people not valuing the money the same way because they've really never been without. I think it's an interesting time to have these wealth building conversations because people really haven't had to think about it. They've had cash flow almost to their fingertips where people need to start thinking differently around their money or else there's going to be a problem.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. The last 10, 12 years, it feels like no matter what you did, you could have made money, right? It was pretty hard to lose, you know, and if you made bad choices, the rising tides kind of lifted you up anyways. So it still turned out okay. I always like to remind people there's a difference between a bad investment that turned out good and a good investment that just happens to turn out bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
Generally speaking, I'm willing to throw my money at something personally that's a good investment that just really could turn out bad, because that's calculated risk.
Yep.
Versus, you know, a bad investment that just you got lucky and it turned out good, right? I really don't want any of those in my portfolio. You run that iteration enough, and we know the law of large numbers tells you you're gonna lose. So
interesting you bring up luck. I was reading this morning, Marcus Aurelius was talking about good fortune. And he says, and good fortunes are a well-tuned soul, good impulses and good actions. So it really has nothing to do with luck. It's like, what have you done to like prep yourself, think through it, making good choices? Yeah. Other people will perceive it as luck, but it really is about like how calculated were you in putting it together. So it's interesting. Yeah. You brought it up when I was reading that this morning. It was interesting. I had someone approach me in the last couple of weeks around, it could potentially be an incredible investment opportunity for me. And it always begs the question, well, if it's that good of a deal, why are you selling it? Right.
Yeah.
Interesting to me that the person that is looking for, they want to stay involved in the investment, but they need to bring in a capital partner, because they've lost a significant portion of their net worth. Because they had an all-in-one basket in a portion of the stock market that happened to be a sector that really crashed hard. And so where they thought they were in a position of forever safety, all of a sudden they're like, oh boy, we're in trouble. We got to start like trying to save some of our other assets around it. Which brings us to the conversation of the day of around a net worth statement. So in this scenario, this person's net worth a year ago looks significant. And now in the blink of an eye, outside of their control of what happened in the market, their net worth is significantly different. So to start our conversation, why don't you give us some of your thoughts on how you define or described your clientele and your partners, the difference between a net worth statement, what is a net worth statement, and a cash flow statement?
Yeah. So a net worth statement it's not really any different than a balance sheet in a business, right? It tracks what you have versus what you owe. And if you subtract what you owe from what you have, you come up with the net value or your net, you know, your personal net worth. The cash flow statement is similar, but instead of tracking the value of assets or the value of what you still owe somebody, it's tracking, you know, what's coming in and what's going out. So income versus expenses. If a balance sheet is kind of your truck, you know, the cash flow is somewhat the drivetrain, you know, if you will. That's the but the money ultimately has to go. The trick is to make the money go from the cash flow statement to the net worth statement somehow.
Yeah. That's interesting as people start to grab this concept and the importance of both of them. Kind of a comment I get regularly is, aren't they the same thing? Which they're, as you just described, they're completely different things and tell a different story of your wealth. Mm-hmm. Then the other comment I get that cracks me up is like, well, I'm too busy to do both of them. So which one should I do? And I'm like, you're not seeing the picture. If you really care about taking ownership of your wealth and driving it forward, it's the net worth statement. It shows you your overall worth and how those assets are allocated. And the cash flow statement plays two pieces in that, right? It's the active income you're creating off of your job and your energy, and you're using that money to actually infuse or grow your asset class in your net worth statement. Mm-hmm. But over time, the passive income on that net worth statement, because there's active income and passive income, is what's going to feed you down the road off of your assets in your net worth statement when you decide and if you decide to retire. So the relationship between those and how you mold them over time are going to determine how much you enjoy your retirement years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I look back to being a small kid playing Robert Kiyosaki's board game Cash Flow.
Yeah.
And if anyone's ever played that game, you know, they've run a balance sheet or a net worth statement and a cash flow statement. They just don't always realize it, right? But that's what the game forces you to do. And the reason I do love that game so much is because it forces people to understand how they work together. So that's the first plug I'll give is if you haven't played that game, get a copy somewhere and play it.
Yeah.
Because it teaches you how they integrate. And I think to your point, what you're saying is you need to build the net worth statement strategically. So that way the assets on your balance sheet are providing opportunity for cash flow on the cash flow statement that's passive versus active. And then as that cash flow, that's income, right, goes to your net cash flow, now you have two opportunities, right? You can spend it, but you can also use it to build more assets that produce more passive cash flow, right? And so all of a sudden they're separate statements, but they start flowing together in different ways. And that's how you build wealth instead of figuring out how to retire. I think those are two different things. And I think one is a little bit more of a, I don't want to use the word scarcity mindset, but right, you're trying to figure out how you're going to make something last and how it's going to, you know, can I make my money last till the end? And the other one is, hey, I'm continually growing and building. It doesn't matter how long I live.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Beautifully said. Yeah. It's interesting. A lot of people think that the word rich and the word wealthy are synonymous, right? That they mean the same thing. And they're, what I would encourage our listeners to think through is what wealth really is to me is that your net worth statement is built in such a way that those assets, without you showing up to work, are creating cash flow that shows up on your cash flow statement in excess of your living expenses. Where on the other, so that would be a wealthy person, is my assets are set up in such a way that they're creating and producing a consistent passive income in excess of my living expenses. A rich person, someone that's perceived to be rich, is one of two things. They either have built up a big asset class, but those assets are not producing income for them, meaning they're non-income producing assets like their primary residence, that boat in the garage, the RV, all these things that they've worked so hard to create. And then on the other side, they might feel like they have a ton of cash flow on their cash flow statement that they're using to buy those fun assets, but it's active income. Meaning if they don't show up to work tomorrow, that cash flow dries up the next day and it's not replaced by the income coming off their assets. So a lot of times in our world, people perceive that person to be rich, when if you really dig into it, they're 1 or 2 months away from a catastrophe from a cash flow statement.
Well, yeah. And cash flow catastrophes turn into net worth catastrophes, right?
Very, very quickly, right? Because that's where you reach for your cash. If your cash is gone, either you or the bank will start reaching for the assets on your net worth statement.
Well, you know, it's an interesting planning exercise that sometimes we go through with clients. Sometimes it's clients that are a little bit, I don't want to say older, but you start getting into your 50s. And you have to have a pretty serious conversation around long-term care, for example, right? Most people are going to experience a long-term care at some point in their life, long-term care event. And, you know, like my grandparents were fortunate enough to fund 7 years of long-term care, 24/7 in-home help. I mean, that's not a cheap expense, but they had the assets to do it, right?
Yeah.
Not everyone has that. There's insurance policies you can get to put in place. There's different ways to plan around it, right? But what's really interesting is to get out the net worth statement and say, okay, when the long-term care event happens, we want to understand in what priority are we going to utilize assets to fund that, right? Are we selling rental properties? Are we selling, you know, liquidating stock holdings? What is it? Because if there's all of a sudden legacy assets, right? Maybe you've developed a portfolio of apartment complexes and you really want to keep that in the family and pass it on to children so they have that passive income earlier in life than you did, then you want to make sure that that's not going to be what's funding the liquidation of that is not what's going to be taking care of you at some point.
That's a great point and a really good example. I mean, you brought up that term, a legacy asset. I think a lot of people are familiar with what assets are. Tell us a little bit more about what a legacy asset is.
I'm at least not aware of a definitive definition around this, but the way that I would classify it is an asset that I want to stay in my family, right? So it's an asset that I want my kid to maintain and benefit from. I really don't care, you know, if I have a Roth IRA of a mixed, you know, mutual funds or ETFs, I couldn't care less if they sell that and take cash and go do whatever. But if I have, you know, again, I just mentioned apartment complexes.
Yep.
if I had a holdings of apartment complexes, man, they're in great locations, great properties. They've been maintained super well. They're really a great, awesome long-term asset, or a closely held business, right? The family business. Someday, my dad hopes to pass a legacy firm opportunity to me, and I'd hope to pass that to my kids. It's a long-term, closely held asset. That's a legacy asset, right? And then the one other thing that I'll include in that maybe is life insurance could be a legacy asset, not in the sense that it's your kids are obviously going to hang on to it, but that it's providing liquidity to keep legacy assets. So yep. If you have a substantial net worth, you might need the liquidity in your estate to keep those assets and yep. not have to sell them to pay some estate taxes. But also the life insurance can ensure that you do pass on a legacy, especially if you meet your demise sooner rather sooner than you expect.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that is the simplest form of a legacy asset is the life insurance policy. And I agree with you. I think this is one of the areas first things I asked you when you and I first started connecting was that idea of the way the majority of the world looks at the end of their world is, am I going to make enough money to make it to my death day? Where in that scenario, nothing lives beyond you. I love that idea of it's not about just building enough money to live on ramen in your last couple of days of life, but it's like, what are you building that will live beyond you that can change the trajectory of your ancestors' lives or whatever charity you want to serve beyond that. So I love that idea of thinking through wealth on a bigger scale of how do I leave a legacy and some assets that continue to produce that income. So let's dive a little bit deeper into a net worth statement first. Let's talk on that side of the scenario. So we're going to keep it pretty simple in asset classes and things like that for this conversation. But just for a quick reminder for people, what is the basic math equation or structure of a net worth statement?
So assets minus liabilities equals net worth.
Pretty simple, right? So let's talk about assets first. I know you and I were talking a little bit beforehand about it. There's different types of assets that live on that sheet. And sometimes there's questions on, is this an asset? Is that an asset? So let's talk through some basic big buckets of what would be considered assets. Walk me through that conversation.
Well, I think what you have to start with that. The big bucket of what's an asset, in my opinion, if you can sell it for any kind of significant value, it's an asset.
Yep.
I know that can be controversial in some different circles, right? Of homes, being assets or not, or liabilities. But at the end of the day, I mean, if you look at the generally accepted accounting principles, that would define that if you can sell it for value and it retains any kind of value, then it's an asset.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. There's two major buckets within that, though, that you have to break it out into, and that's in investment assets or personal use assets.
Yep, love it. So the terms I use on that are very similar. I use income producing assets or non-income producing assets. So mm-hmm. Right, same scenario you're talking about is it an asset that produces income for me that I can count on to be a legacy asset, or is it one that I've an asset that I bought that I could sell if I needed to, but I really bought it for my personal use, right?
Yeah.
And so I think this is an interesting conversation to have with kids growing up because that's going to help with their decision making powers. They'll be driving down the road and you point to the Tesla next to you and you say, is that a income producing asset or a non-income producing asset? And then you point to that diesel truck that's driving with you on the other side of you that's like pulling a big old cargo. Is that an asset for that company, or is that an income producing asset or a non-income producing asset? They're both on wheels moving down the freeway, but they have different purposes and they show up differently on someone's net worth statement.
Well, and that's what makes everything with wealth is always unique, and you got to understand it's unique to your own situation, because, to take that conversation one step wilder is, what if it's a Tesla, but it's part of a fleet of, EVs that somebody owns as a company that they're rentals or some, thing, right? Yeah. All of a sudden it's an asset, Not the cash flowing asset or cash producing asset. So
yeah.
Everyone's playing a different game, and it's, the it's not the specific asset that determines whether it's an investment asset or a personal use asset. It's your own personal situation and use of that asset. That, you know, is it for your own personal enjoyment or is it to help you build a legacy, right?
Yep. Yeah, I think it's a great point. So a couple of quick points I'd like to make to our group of entrepreneurs that listen to this is, one is we're talking about a personal net worth statement. Your business assets should be on your business balance sheet. And then on your personal net worth statement, maybe an ownership stake in that business. The other comment that I would make on this that I get regularly in regards to a net worth statement is, the market, like, for example, we've had this huge run up on the real estate market and I get in an argument with some of my friends where they really maximize the value of those assets on the net worth statement. And I tend to be very conservative in that, right? So if I knew this rental property in the market a year and a half ago could have sold for $550 and now I could sell it for $475. I still have been running the value of those type of assets so conservatively from a valuation standpoint that even in a market coming down, I haven't had to shift at all because I tend to be more conservative in that. However, the liability is the liability. You put that exactly what it is in the moment. That's how you calculate true net worth.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with that one in particular, there's a couple different ways to do it. I think particularly with real estate, there's two effective ways to manage the value of that asset. The first one is to, you know, take what you think the fair market value is. And I will roll off 7 to 8% off that value, figuring the cost of sale. The other way to do it is to take what it produces as an income producing property. And if it's in your investment assets, right, this should be really easy to do because it should be producing some kind of income.
Yep.
What's the capitalization rate on your net income annually on that? Right. Mm-hmm. And what would the capitalization rate be for you to want to rebuy it today?
Yeah.
That's the value. Like to me, that's the real value. That's what people are, you know. So if it's going to sell at an 8 cap now because rates are higher and things are coming down, you want to be really honest with yourself about what your net worth is. You might want to value it that way. It can be brutal, especially in the current market conditions with rising rates. But it puts you in a place where you're a little bit uncomfortable and say, "Ooh, that's my net worth." You know, I was feeling like I was a millionaire and maybe I'm really not the millionaire I thought I was. I got to keep at this. Right.
Yep.
So,
I encourage everyone from an asset standpoint, be very detailed on there of whether it's an income producing asset or a non-income producing asset. On your income producing assets, I would still say be fairly conservative on that. On your non-income producing assets, I'm very conservative on that. Like, even on my cars and toys, I really tend to undervalue them. I basically look at, if I had to sell this today on a fire sale, what could I walk down the street and get it for?
Yeah.
And that's what I value my non-income producing assets, except my personal residence, as I run that a little bit higher, as if I had like 30 or 60 days to sell it, what could I sell it?
Yeah.
So ultimately that's what, unless there's something else you wanted to add with an asset class there, is I would just make sure I would put them in as income producing assets, non-income producing assets. If you have ownership in a business, which a lot of us do on this call, if we have ownership in our businesses, I tend to run that pretty conservative as well, particularly if my intent is not to sell that business, but to keep that business for cash flow. Because a lot of times I'll let those run on my net worth statement for the cash that I'm into it. My cash investment into that property is a lot of times what I'll show on my net worth statement until for some reason I had to value that company for something else. I got a true valuation of it and figured out my portion of it. And then I'd figure out a conservative number on that is how I treat those assets on my personal net worth statement. Any other comment on assets before we talk about liabilities?
No.
Okay. Awesome. Liabilities. Tell us some of your thoughts on liabilities.
Liabilities is something that has a debt. It's a debt, right? Liabilities is a debt section. There's two categories of debt, right? There's current and non-current. So You could also think of that as like short-term and not short-term. So from an accounting standpoint, a current is usually something that's due within the next year.
Yep.
You know, and non-current is something that's due further out than that. So like credit cards are always, and I'm going to lump signature loans in that, like any of that unsecured debt, line of credits, all that's current liabilities, right? Then you have non-current is going to be your, you know, your mortgage, your investment related debts. If you have any, you could potentially do vehicle loans or recreational vehicle loans in there. Although I'd just like to encourage people to try to not have those. But if you do have them, that's where they go. But when you are tracking liabilities, you might, if you want to get really complicated with it, you could take what you're going to owe on that loan in the next 12 months and drop that as a line item in the current liabilities.
Yep. Love that. I think that's a really good description of that. I a lot of times I talk about, because some people try to give this idea of all debt is bad debt. And I think debt is actually one of debt is similar to leverage, right? And you're leveraging something by using other people's money. If you use leverage appropriately, you can build your net worth and get a higher return on the right asset classes. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you use debt inappropriately, it could be the thing that buries your net worth at a very fast pace. So it is either an accelerator, a very quick accelerator of building your worth, or it can actually be not even brakes on it, but a decelerator. Like it's going to push you backwards if it's used inappropriately. So as a lot of my listeners know, I talk a lot about money rules. Is one of my personal money rules that I just really encourage people to live by, and you already touched on it, is to not carry consumer debt. And I refuse to take loans on non-income producing assets. The only one that I feel okay with some people is on your primary residence. A lot of times to get into a primary residence, depending on where you are in your career, is a non-income producing asset, but to get a loan on it, because you can get normally a more competitive interest rate on your personal home, which then gives you more assets to go build wealth. But from that boat, that razor, those type of things, like for me, there really is very little excuse to get a loan on that type of product if you're serious about building long-term wealth.
Well, I think the one thing that's allows for that one exception, right? The loan on the primary residence is, if you buy a truck or a car or a boat or a razor or any of those things, and you buy, I'm going to call it, I heard this phrase, I believe it's a Gary Keller thing, right? Buying luxury on margin. If you take that loan, the razor will almost undoubtedly, okay, like let's get bar 2021 and 2022 out of there. Like,
yeah,
zoom out a little bit. It's going to go down in value every year, right? Whereas your primary residence does have the ability to hopefully inflation adjust and increase in value. Obviously, there's no guarantee there.
Yeah, but the high likelihood.
The high likelihood that the home is going to continue to, you know, increase in value incrementally over the years while the loan's decreasing. That's what makes it acceptable, right? That's where you can use, that can be healthy leverage on a primary residence. Although depending on where your risk tolerance is, you still might want to just get your primary mortgage paid off.
Yep. So we're very much in alignment with that. So this is where people love to add up their assets and think, look at all this stuff that I own. What they don't like to do is have a real conversation around their liabilities, right? To say like, what do I owe? Cause that doesn't feel good. In these little, for a lot of people, these little $100 payments here and a $400 payment there and a $75 payment there, they feel inconsequential, but they're working against their ability to build long-term wealth. So to kind of wrap up this part of the conversation, I would encourage you, number one, is make a list of all your debts on your net worth statement, highlight any of them that are considered consumer debt. And I would write out the APR next to them. And if you write out the APR on some of the credit cards and stuff you're carrying, you're going to feel sick to your stomach. And then one of the first things I would focus on is how quickly can you get rid of that consumer debt? And you'll notice that having a huge impact on your net worth. Because we talked about assets, you add up your assets, you add up your liabilities, you minus the liabilities after it. Hopefully what's left over is a positive number. And that would be your net worth. Anything else we should be talking about on a net worth statement?
No, I think one of the things that you kind of taught me was to track that on a monthly basis. And I like that concept. So I have started to implement that myself, and would encourage everyone to do the same. Track a net worth statement and a monthly cash flow statement on a monthly basis. Close out your month and look at your progress.
Love that. That was one of the first things my first mentor in real estate asked me to do. Is actually a job requirement. I was an assistant to him, Tom Calder, and part of my job requirement with him was that I had to track my net worth every month. And he and I had a conversation around it. And as a 21-year-old kid, that was not a fun conversation to be having. However, it got me in the habit of it, and it made me get really purposeful in it, because it's all about what's the goal of the goal. It's not just about making money this year. It's about building a long-term legacy. And that shows up in what your net worth statement looks like. Everything I want to do with my family and in my life takes some element of funds to do it. It can either be active funds or passive income funds that are paying for it. And I'm hoping as the farther I get down this path we call life, is that it's my passive income paying for those experiences, not me eliminating experiences because I don't want to work anymore. So I love that you've adopted that. And I encourage everybody the exact same thing. Is every month it should be your net worth statement. And we put together goals around our income goals. There should be goals around how much do you want to affect your net worth in any given year.
Yeah.
Cash flow statement. What do you want to talk through on a cash flow statement?
So obviously you have your income and your expenses. Your income though, I just break it out. I think that's one of the biggest things people don't do, is they say, okay, well, my income, I just add up all my income and there's what it is. If you have no passive income, write zero under passive income, right? If you don't have any business income, write zero. You know what I mean? The only one that you are trying to get to zero is job income. And you want to see that draw down over the years, right? As you transition to business income, which hopefully becomes passive income, you know, by not managing the business. And true investment income, you know, that's considered passive, and potentially other income. So you could get other income like from debt sources or different things. But then you have expenses, right? Track what those expenses are, see where your stuff's going. And what I found is the more that there could be a lot of expenses in people's monthly kind of statements, right? Like, I mean, if you break it down to like, I'm paying, you know, for Netflix and iCloud and all these things, right? It gets to be a lot. Kind of, if you need to group them up to make it simple, put what you're making for payments on short-term debt, put what you're making for payments on long-term debt, you know, put what you're paying to run your household or major expenses like that, group them up. But what you can start seeing when you do that is, oh my gosh, I didn't realize how much I was paying in this category. Maybe I need to dive in deeper to that, because I was expecting that income and the expenses to net out at, I should have $5,000 at the end of the month. Where the heck is that $5,000? Because I don't usually have it, right?
Yeah.
You can go start trying to track it down. Or if you go, my gosh, there's $0 at the end of the month, and that's even what the statement's saying I should have. Well, I can't have that because I need to get money from this cash flow statement to flow back to the net worth statement, right? I got to buy assets. Yeah. So I need money to go buy the assets. So, but now you have the categories where one's standing out, like, oh my gosh, that is taking a lot of my income. You know where to start looking and focusing your efforts.
Well said. I think that's a piece that a lot of people miss, is one of those expense line items should be investing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is an expense, because you have to send that money out, but it should go from your cash flow. It's not just money coming from your assets feeding your cash flow statement. Some of that cash flow should be restacking back into new assets onto your net worth statement.
So like myself specifically, I have specific financial goals that me and my wife have, that we have that as an expense, if you will, right? And it's just simple stuff, right? An example would be if somebody wanted to put like, hey, I want to make sure I fund my Roth IRA, right? Yep. Or or I'm trying to put money together for a down payment on an investment property. So I'm specifically funding a certain account with a certain amount each month. But then what I'm looking to do is still track all the money coming in. And even if after that, there's, you know, 200, it doesn't matter if there's 200 or 2000 or $20,000. I want to know how much there is because I want to go buy assets with them, right? Like I want to, I still want to take that money and go buy more assets personally, right? I don't want to say, oh, okay, well, I funded my asset, you know, a liability, if you will, or, you know, expense. Yeah. So now this is, you know, money to do whatever I want with. Use it to intentionally fund goals. And if you don't have a specific goal, like just go buy some assets, right?
That's right.
Just go buy some assets.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting. And the other comment I get from people that they somehow people have this delusion of let's say they make $150,000 a year and they think, oh, if I all my expenses are covered, I'm living a good life, whatever. And somehow they think in their mind that when they turn 60, at some point they're gonna be like, I'm gonna retire, but somehow magically I'm gonna continue to make $150,000 passively. Cause they get frustrated that their passive income starts at $1,000 a year, right? Or on very small interest or whatever it is. But don't get discouraged on that. That's a seed. You started something special there, and you'll see that compound interest is a real thing. If every dollar you're making, if a portion of that is going to build the assets, the right assets on your net worth statement, you will see that passive income grow at a very fast pace. And that takes time. It takes effort. This is why most people don't retire at the age they want to retire. And most people don't retire with the passive income or the net worth they want, is because it takes time. It takes a process. You have to start and you have to nurture it. You have to take care of it and plan it and make these decisions to do it. But that's where it starts to show up. It's not this magic solution to do it. It's learning the skill set and taking it seriously. Nobody should care about your money more than you do. And this is how you do it, is looking at your net worth statement and your cash flow statement on a regular basis.
Yeah. Yeah. I never want to plug any specific investment, right? This isn't specific advice to anyone, but it's an observation I've had. And that's that, and what sparked my mind, what sparked this in my mind is where you're saying, hey, you know, oh, someone might only make $1,000 a year on passive cash flow on an investment or something, and they're frustrated. They feel like it's not worth it.
Yep.
But I have yet to sit down with, a client or prospective client that owns, at least one free and clear rental property that is not going to have the ability to retire.
Hmm.
I haven't found that yet. Right. So,
yeah.
There's a lot to be said about real estate and different ways to do it or handle it, but it's just an interesting observation that if somebody's had at least one rental property free and clear, and that's not a lot of net worth, right?
Oh.
Like in many cases you're talking $300,000-$400,000, not a lot, but, what that started with, whenever you see that typically that somebody owns a property free and clear, is 30 years ago, they bought the house and they've just stayed with it, right? Stayed consistent and boom, now they're looking to retire and they have this property that's unencumbered. And you know, I wish I would have sat down with them 5 years ago so that we could have leveraged it the right way and kind of, you know, built some more wealth for them. But you know, they're at least in a place where they have some passive income and it's a lot different conversation than, well, if we try to keep some risk on in your 401k and you know, only take this much out per year, but it's going to get taxed in this kind of unfavorable way. And, you know, hopefully you don't last till you're 95 because we're really going to be having some issues if you do.
Yeah.
That's a way different conversation to have with people than, hey, I have my 401k or, you know, my IRAs, but it's providing the liquidity to have flexibility with different things that I want to do because they're more liquid assets.
Yep.
And I don't go tap those liquidity accounts for, you know, cash flow.
Yeah.
It's a lot different.
It's such a different conversation. I think that gives a pretty good summary of both the net worth statement and the cash flow statement. You know, sometimes people look at the cash flow statement as almost like a budget. And it's a little bit deeper than that, but it's what that tool you would use to track your income, broken down into type of income minus expenses. But hopefully our listenership found some value in that conversation. What I would encourage everyone to do to as we wrap up our conversation today is if you haven't taken the time recently to sit down and put together your net worth statement and your cash flow statement, number one is just commit to do it. I promise you the first time it feels clunky. It takes a little bit of time and energy, but if you do it a couple of times, it really doesn't take that much time every month. It's just like you kind of go through the motion, you know how to do it. The first couple of times you have to think through it a little bit more. If you're already in the habit of putting together your net worth statement and your cash flow statement, and it's a habit for you, I would encourage you, because of the economic landscape we're in now, is this month when you put it together, give it a little bit of extra time and energy to sit on it and not just put it together to put it together off of a habit. But actually look at it and say, does this net worth and cash flow statement serve future me? Is this the tool? Like if I looked back retrospectively to me at 43, which that's how old I am now, would I think that's the right mix of my asset classes and the cash flow it's producing that's going to serve the future version of me? Because as we're coming into a market, even to myself, one of the things I'm looking at is that I'm shifting some of my asset classes based on the market we're coming into. One of the things I'm most concerned about is the value of the dollar moving forward. And there's some uncertainty there. However, the value of a hard asset that people will need, like a residential home, regardless of what the value of the dollar does, there's gonna be a demand for that product. Right. So I'm re-looking at my asset classes. And so every once in a while we put together a game plan, you execute it, but then you have to sometimes sit on that and say, is this still the game plan based on what I know now?
Yeah. That's what I always tell people. If they're working with a financial planner and the financial planner gives them a plan, they've done them a disservice, because it's not a packet. It's a living thing. You know, I would be terrified if I, you know, flew in a plane and the pilot was like, well, I set course, I'm gonna hop off here and this thing should fly itself to the destination, you know, like,
right?
They need to sit in that seat still and help make those small corrections as the variables change a little bit, right? So
yeah,
and I think that's what tracking net worth and cash flow on a monthly basis helps you do, is have that awareness and make the course corrections when they can remain small, instead of having to make drastic changes later on.
Yep. Love it. All right, Enchilada Nation, we're going to wrap up here. Brandon, if some of the videos you've been turning out lately, by the way, are awesome. Just great little nuggets of information. Where do people find you if they want to connect with you and follow some of the stuff you're doing?
Primarily on Facebook or Instagram. My business page is just called Ducharme Financial. People are also always welcome to add me on. I'm primarily on Facebook.
How do you spell Ducharme so they can find you?
Yeah.
How do they spell Ducharme so they can find you?
Well, they got to get Brandon right first sometimes. B-R-A-N-D-E-N, but Ducharme is D-U-C-H-A-R-M-E.
Perfect. Awesome, buddy. Appreciate you. Appreciate your knowledge and chatting through this stuff with me. Look forward to connecting more on it, and we'll talk soon.